Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frogs of War Radio Show. I am Jamie. She is Melissa, and we're here tonight to preview TCU's third game of the season. It's coming up on Saturday morning at 11 o'clock Central Time, so get your tailgates out early, get your breakfast food ready. The Frogs are taking on the Cyclones from Iowa State. Melissa, in years past, we would say that this would be, you know, an easy win for TCU, but I'm not totally convinced of that this year. Are you?
I don't know that easy win is something we need to keep around in our vernacular a whole lot. When you look at it historically, too, against the quote-unquote bottom of the barrel in the Big 12, which are Kansas and Iowa State, other than one game in Fort Worth against Iowa State, none of these have really been gimmies anyways. And when you look at what we're throwing out there so far in the first two games of the season with allowing 41 points a game, I'd say, you know, we might be in for a little bit of an interesting battle here for four quarters Saturday morning.
It definitely could be. Definitely could be. You know, that 2014 team, like you mentioned, just destroyed Iowa State in their final game of the season, 55-3, and it still wasn't enough to get TCU into the college football playoff, even though they were ranked three going into that weekend. So that says a lot about what people think about Iowa State. I don't know that that perception has changed much over the past 2 years. But last year, Iowa State did give TCU problems up in Ames. You know, they took a lead early. They maintained, or they at least kept pace with TCU through the first half and through some of the third quarter before TCU finally turned on the gas and pulled away. And so it's really going to be an interesting game on Saturday, especially with the way the TCU secondary has been playing, Melissa, and especially with Iowa State's wide receiver, Alan Lazard. This is a kid who can be a dominant receiver. He's one of the only receivers, if not the only receiver in FBS, to have 100-yard receiving games back-to-back to open the season this year. You know, he's already got 13 receptions for 240 yards and a touchdown on the season, and he's definitely one of those kids that can stretch you out and just blow the top off of a defense. And, you know, with the way TCU secondary has been playing, that's a big concern, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. And the thing that's even more impressive about Alan Lazard is when you hear those stats, they jump off the page at you. But when you look at who's been throwing him the ball and the lack of, you know, talent around him at that position, it's really, really impressive that he's been able to rack up those so far this season when, you know, there's not anybody else taking the attention off of him. And the other guy that's supposed to be part of that three-headed monster for the Cyclones, Mike Warren, has done nothing so far this season. Mm-hmm. So Lazard is a special talent. I'll never understand how they got him up to Ames, but it really is. It's, you don't want to say it's unfortunate that, you know, he's kind of wasting his talent there, but you almost wish that Iowa State would find a quarterback that they can kind of get the job done a little bit more consistently, just to let a kid like that shine, because he is fun to watch when the ball's in the air.
Well, he definitely is. And the fact that he has been able to perform at the level that we've seen him perform and during his career at Iowa State, I think is a testament to his talent, especially when you consider the fact that their quarterback play has been consistently inconsistent. Joel Lanning, Iowa State's quarterback, is only completing 54% of his passes on the season. He's only thrown three touchdowns, and he's already thrown three interceptions. So considering that he is not the greatest quarterback on the planet, and Lazard has all except 100 yards of Lanning's completed passing yards, you know, it's amazing that Lazard has been able to do all of the things that he's doing up there.
Well, now what we haven't taken to impact yet is the last two games that TCU has played this season, the first two games of the season, two quarterbacks that were slightly unheralded or at least inexperienced have gone on to have career days against the Frogs. And the question looms heading into week three with another talented but inconsistent quarterback stepping foot in Fort Worth. Is this more indicative of the TCU defense or a little bit combination of these guys just hitting their spots at the right time. I don't think it's out of the question that Joel Anning has a career type good day in Fort Worth, unless something's changed defensively for TCU, especially in the front line.
Yeah, you got to get some pressure. It's something that, you know, was minimal against South Dakota State and even less so against Arkansas. You know, and granted, Arkansas always has massive offensive lines. It's just the way that Brett Bielema constructs his team. But now you're getting into a part of the schedule where you're hitting some of these offenses that are going to be a little bit smaller because they're looking to spread things out and move a little bit quicker. And so now is really when we need to start seeing the defensive line really get pressure, especially push up the middle with Curry and Broadnax and all of these kids. LJ Collier, you know, you got the big rock Blacklock in there. All of these kids are going to need to start pushing up the middle a little bit and destroying that pocket and throwing Joel Anning off. Not that he ever looks like he's not thrown off, but, you know, just really getting some pressure and allowing the secondary to cover for 1 or 2 seconds and then just get their head turned and look for the ball rather than having to cover for 4, 5, 6 seconds.
Well, the offensive line is a real area of weakness for the Cyclones this year. And part of the reason that Mike Warren has struggled so far is that they really just can't get any consistent play up front. And so, like you said, Arkansas had a great offensive line. South Dakota State had a very veteran offensive line that had played together for quite a while. And so this might be the first opportunity that Gary Patterson felt like he could really turn guys loose. And I think it's time that we see that happen. You can't put Tejada and Gladney and whoever else, you know, in the back end on an island for that long and expect them to be successful when one of them is a redshirt freshman and the other guy is coming off of a devastating knee injury a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd really love to see those guys just kind of pin their ears back and go for the quarterback. And while Lanning is, I believe, the leading rusher for Iowa State so far this year, he's not the threat to go and break off the 20-yard run. He's just not that kind of player. And so I don't think you have to worry as much about getting burned on the outside, more about just put that guy at his rear end and force him into making some mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we did get some information from Gary Patterson at his press conference on Tuesday, Melissa, that Montrell Wilson, linebacker for the Frogs, is out with an unidentified injury. And so that's a loss for the Frogs that they're going to have to endure for at least this week, possibly weeks to come. But, you know, I was pretty impressed, actually, with the linebacker play against Arkansas. And we talked about this a lot with Robert Henson on Sunday, with Sammy Douglas and Ty Summers, the way that they played. And I think they combined for, what, like 27 tackles. You know, I feel like the Montrell Wilson loss at this point is a little bit mitigated by the fact that Sammy Douglas looks like he's back completely healthy now, and Ty Summers stepped up last week and looked really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a team, again, like Arkansas, where you're not going to be hurt too much by having those bigger guys that maybe aren't quite as fast, but, you know, hit a little bit harder, fill the gaps a little bit better, and have a little bit more ability to pressure the quarterback just with their combination of size and strength. You know, when you play South Dakota State, when you play Baylor, when you play Oklahoma State, there is a benefit to having the smaller, faster guys that are almost like safeties in the middle, or in TCU's case, are actually former safeties in the middle of the defense. But against Iowa State, you know, against SMU even, which is trying to run that up-tempo, but with the loss of Matt Davis is a very different team. You can afford to lose a little bit of speed and exchange it for size and hopefully a little bit surer tackling. The question becomes now, obviously with depth is going to be an issue for TCU in the middle, which is something that we've been dealing with now for 2 seasons. And then also, you know, how does Traven Howard fit into this defense now? Moved him to safety last week and didn't seem to have the impact on the game that we're used to him seeing. I'm sure part of that is just kind of going back to a position he hasn't practiced at a year. And, you know, part of that also may have just been matchups because, you know, the tight ends for Arkansas, of course, are just huge as well. But hopefully he can have a little bit more game impact, maybe give Ranthony Tejada a little bit of help over the top on Lazard. Yes, thank you. That guy, he's kind of a big deal. You know, give a little bit of help on Lazard as well, just because he's another really big receiver, and Tejada has struggled with those somewhat this year.
Yeah, and, you know, just watching Wilson last year, he played well at linebacker, but his body type just never looked like it was going to fill out enough, mm-hmm. even to be a smaller linebacker in this 4-2-5. And so it's probably best for him and for his body type and his speed ability for him to shift back to safety and really kind of play at a position where his natural abilities mm-hmm. will really let him, be a big contributor. You've got Montrell Wilson down there who has managed to put on a little bit more weight. And then, like you said, you've got these bigger guys. And again, it seems like Iowa State specifically, where they don't have a very strong offensive line, their running game isn't as good as it probably could be. And where their depth at wide receiver isn't that great, you can sacrifice a little bit of speed at the linebacker position for those bigger guys who can bottle up the run and make sure that Iowa State is as one-dimensional as TCU can make them.
Absolutely. I think the other thing, too, is that one of the things we've kind of talked about that we're lacking is maybe that football IQ, that leadership in the back end. And I think the one thing we know about Traven Howard and Montrell Wilson is they both seem to have pretty high football IQs. They made that adjustment to linebacker so quickly that they, they picked up schemes and everything that I would trust that if they can go back to their more natural position of safety, maybe they can have an impact on the coverages being adapted a little bit quicker, guys being in the right spot a little bit faster, and just taking some leadership role in the back end, which seems to be what's really been lacking in the secondary.
Definitely, because now you've got Howard back there and you've got Nick Orr, who played a little bit at corner last year, who's, solidly at safety this year. And you've got those two guys, like you said, they really know multiple positions really well. And hopefully that does expedite play calling. Like Henson said last week, Gary Patterson is notorious for getting calls in late, which means that defenders really have a minimal amount of time to get the call in, read the offense, and then get where they're supposed to be. So any kind of extended knowledge that you can have as a player definitely benefits the whole defense.
Absolutely. Well, and hopefully mm-hmm. we see the reward of that, heading into the first game of Big 12 play. We saw flashes of effectiveness in that first half against Arkansas, but in the second half, it was a little bit more of the same of guys moving up and down the field. And the one thing you can't give a big underdog on the road is hope. And
exactly.
We've seen this with Iowa State before. If they break a couple runs, if Lazard hauls in a deep ball, if Lanning gets a couple completions under his belt, things could spiral downhill quickly. And what we don't want to see in Fort Worth, though they sure were exciting those first two games, is another second half comeback attempt. I don't think my little heart can take it for a third straight game, especially at 11 a.m.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But, really the last time Iowa State was competitive with TCU in Fort Worth was that 2012 game, which was Boykin's first start ever. He was a freshman, and he only had, a half of a practice to really get under center and work at all with the ones in that capacity because he had just been moved to running back. And so you've got an Iowa State team that won that game 37-23. Boykin threw, I think, three interceptions.
Four. I think so.
But, but beyond that, Iowa State plays a lot of people close at home. We see that consistently year to year, regardless of how good Iowa State is. They always seem to rise up for one or two of the bigger teams in the Big 12. And so I just, this year at home, if the offense finally hits a rhythm like they can, if the defense starts to figure it out a little bit more, figure out their positioning a little bit more, and starts to get more comfortable, this could be a game that we look back to this season and say, look, they lost to Arkansas the week before that. And then Iowa State is really where they started to figure things out. And they just looked like they started to click on both sides of the football.
Well, yeah. And it's really easy to say after a loss, but the old adage of you learn more from a loss than a win sometimes probably rings true in this scenario. And so I think we'll start to see at the very least what this TCU team is made up from a mentality standpoint. And I just said so many coach speak words that I kind of want to vomit on myself. But at the end of the day, it remains true. We got to see what these guys are made of. They're young. Patterson likes to keep reminding us of that. They're inexperienced. And while they've all played for a season earlier than they probably thought they had to, they don't have that many snaps under their belt as a whole. And so how are they going to respond? Who is going to develop as a leader in the locker room? Who is going to be the one that yanks these guys around by their collars on the field and says, we got to get this done? Because at the end of the day, know, if we've said it a million times, that Arkansas loss hurt. It hurt really bad when I had to put a hog nose on at work the Monday afterwards. But it doesn't do anything to stop our run for a Big 12 championship. And while, you know, I think we all kind of maybe are looking at the season a little bit differently, every team in the Big 12 is 0-0 right now. Oh, there's more of that. Golly, I'm a cliche machine. So, you know, but we're all in the same boat. And there's no reason to lose hope before you played a conference game of actually having a chance to win a conference title. And so the Frogs can get some momentum. They can get some confidence. That game against SMU, which was horrifying to me just a few days ago, looks slightly less horrifying to me with the unfortunate injury to Matt Davis, who's lost for the year with an ACL tear.
That's
still really talented.
For them.
Yeah, and for him too. Like, seems like a really good kid. From a football standpoint, you know, it definitely changes the dynamic of their teams. But just from a college football fan standpoint, hate to see that. I would like to have seen SMU kind of turn the corner this year. After next, you know, next week. But that, I think that really does hurt them. So a lot of momentum can be built here in the next 2 weeks, heading into Oklahoma by a team that maybe just starts to show up and play a full four quarters, because we have yet to see that this year too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, these next 2 weeks are critical, I think, for TCU to really find their footing and to really start to get some momentum going heading into Oklahoma and then Kansas and West Virginia, Texas Tech in October. That's a tough October.
Oof. And I'm in the process of booking my flight to West Virginia. So I think I'm going out there. Made some good friends here through Frogs of War with some of the Smoking Musket guys, and I think I'm gonna go set fire to a couch with some moonshine here in a couple weeks. So let's hope TCU has got their stuff together before I drop all that money on flights and et cetera to go on that trip. But I think it'd be a good time. Well worth it.
You know, West Virginia, gosh, that's one of those games. I think when we did our big bad preview right before the season started, we had five, I think, of the six staff writers for Frogs Award picked West Virginia to win that game. And that's not looking like a bad pick right now.
Yeah, I mean, they started off pretty strong. You know, as the Big 12 has kind of scuffled here through the first couple of days, West Virginia, or first couple weeks of the season, West Virginia is one who has quietly performed pretty well and didn't look great against the Fighting Bo Pelinis. But at the same time, you know, they're 2-0. They have an SEC skin on their belt, and they'll have an opportunity against BYU this weekend to make a little bit more of a national statement.
Yeah, you know, BYU's got an opportunity to really, really put a good thing on their resume, I guess, by, you know, for expansion to the Big 12 by saying, look, well, we beat West Virginia this year. Woo.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, but hey, who knows what that win's going to look like here, you know, for TCU, if they can handle BYU. But, you know, as we watch Houston struggling with Cincinnati, who's a, you know, a battle of two wannabe Big 12s, and you see BYU go and try to take down West Virginia this weekend, this is a big weekend for Big 12 wannabes, just like it is for the Big 12 teams.
It definitely is. Definitely is. And I haven't
if there's a Big 12 wannabe. Yeah, if there's a Big 12
I think
wannabe.
There are. I think there are still a few out there in that big old world that we live in. But I think that number might be getting smaller and smaller once people saw how the Big 12 started to play football this year.
This
granted,
is
it
true.
it did look like Arizona was really making a good, strong bid for the Big 12 this past Saturday when they were just getting thumped by Grambling State there for a little bit.
They'd fit right in.
They would fit right in. They would fit in. So
I would take their band, though. I mean, they've got a pretty good – did you see the story between the Grambling State and the Arizona band, how they kind of recreated that famous joint performance at halftime?
Yeah, I saw a little bit about it. I think I posted a link to the Monday Morning Quarterback this week. But say more about that for the people that missed it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty neat. So Arizona and Grambling State, and I'm going to get the dates wrong on this, play kind of broke through some of the racial lines to play a joint halftime show at the Super Bowl decades ago. And so this is the first time that these two bands have been together since, and I'm even pulling up the story here, right, to make sure I get my facts straight. So for the first time since 1966, These two bands played together at halftime. This was in January 1967 when they actually played together at the halftime show of the Super Bowl at Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. And it was, you know, obviously one of those life-altering, life-changing events, and had a lot to do with all the civil rights unrest that there was in this country. Those two bands coming together, performing on that field in front of the nation, really was very symbolic, and also, you know, started to kind of help heal the nation at that time. And so the two schools met for the first time last weekend, and these two bands practiced together and actually recreated that exact halftime show at halftime of that game. And so, you know, with everything that's been going on, obviously there's just so much tension, and you know, we had a very violent couple of years in America on both sides. Mm-hmm. And with the Colin Kaepernick, how that has really just evolved into, I think it's brokered more discussions on racial tension than anything else that we've seen so far this year. It was really powerful and poignant to see those two bands get together on the field at halftime, perform together, and harken back to a time in history that was obviously a difficult and a painful, and in a lot of ways, it's a really horrifying time for people of the African-American community, and celebrate that unity that was shared, you know, 50 plus years ago, once again on the field in Arizona, and hopefully just kind of to college football fans and speak to the world in a show of unity and support. And I thought it was just kind of a really beautiful thing to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're right, with all of the Kaepernick drama that has been happening lately, with people taking a gesture, a good use of free speech, in my opinion, and really just, you know, try to belittle and bemoan his actions and the actions of those that are kind of following his lead around the NFL and throughout sports. You know, it is good to point back to times where, at least for a brief moment, unity was a successful idea, and to just call back to that when it seems like that is very, very far away, just day in and day out in our current climate.
Do you think, and not to take this too far off the rails, obviously we have a big game coming up this weekend, but do you think that we'll see anybody kneeling during the national anthem at the college ranks, or do you think college head coaches have too much of a thumb on their programs?
You know, I don't know. I'm going to assume that most coaches have done some sort of forum on it with their players, maybe not some so formal as a forum, but have at least had a conversation with their players about, you know, racial tension in this country and, you know, what it means to be on the football field and what kind of example are you setting. And I don't know that coaches have necessarily swayed players away from or towards making a statement like that. But I do know, I do assume that most coaches have at least had that conversation with their players to make them aware of the impact that they can have by making a gesture like that. You know, it definitely wouldn't have as big of an impact, I think, as like Kaepernick or, you know, all of those guys on Miami or the linking of the arms by Seattle or anything like that. But, you know, if you're like starting quarterback for Ohio State and you're on ESPN in Norman this week and you take a knee during the national anthem, people are going to notice. And so, you know, I have pretty strong opinions on that whole situation generally. So I'm not going to reveal too much about myself there, but you know, I would hope that coaches have had conversations with their kids about the impact that it can have. And then ultimately I hope that the coaches leave it up to the kids to make that decision for themselves. To say, you know, if you feel like this is a political statement that you need to make, then we are not going to, you know, prohibit your First Amendment rights by telling you that you can't do that. But I don't think it's detrimental to a kid to have a conversation about impact when it comes to something like that.
And it's been, you know, surprisingly quiet outside of Dabo Swinney's little, I don't know what to call it. We'll call it a answer to a question to keep things, you know, kosher here, but we just haven't heard a lot of coaches speak on it openly to the press. And I think you're probably right in that they're handling it. I think that it's probably one of those things that we'll really never know what exactly has been happening behind the scenes and until something does happen, you know, on the national television. Ohio State, Oklahoma will be interesting to watch, Florida State, Louisville, if any, any players take a stand now that we've seen several NFL players not only, you know, silently join the protests, but, you know, to put it bluntly, kind of put their money where their mouth is and are giving to causes, are meeting with police chiefs, and are really trying to open a discussion and a dialogue to hopefully see things change and see things get better.
Yeah, because ultimately it's not about the taking a knee. It's not about, you know, the holding up the fist. It's not about the gestures that are made during the national anthem. It's about what those gestures and those nonverbal cues motivate people to do. Because ultimately people can hold their fist in the air, they can lock arms, and they can do all this, that, and the other. You know, they can lay down in the street. But unless, you know, they're working towards, you know, progress, if they're working towards change off the field, and if they're, you know, speaking to people about how to go about making that change off the field, you know, a fist in the air is just a fist in the air. And
absolutely.
So I liked that Kaepernick was giving copious amounts of money to certain groups in the California area. You know, he did get hammered, I think, right away when he took a knee, or I guess when he sat for the first time, and say, well, you make so much money. Shouldn't you be thankful to this country that allowed you to be adopted by great parents and to be athletic and to make millions and millions of dollars? And so, you know, his response was like, well, yeah, I'm giving a lot of that money away. And, you know, I think just in a time where we are so polarized, to take that next step and to do what Kaepernick's been doing, I think is the necessary next.
For sure.
And I don't know if I answered anything, or I really kind of forgot why I got on that tangent, but you know.
Well, you know, I think that
we have
an awesome forum to discuss TCU football, but I think that, you know, a lot of TCU fans, just like any fans across the country, are wondering about some of these issues too, and kind of trying to parse through them and find out what's important to them. And, you know, ultimately, most people that are listening to us right now probably just want to see how it relates back to TCU. And, you know, if we see, you know, anybody kneeling in on the sidelines this weekend or any time through the season, it may change the direction of the conversation. But for now, it's just interesting to kind of hear your opinions and your thoughts. And it's, you know, every radio show feels obligated to talk about it to some degree, apparently. So might as well join in as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Melissa, we have a caller who is calling in now. We don't know who it is, but we're going to find out soon. Hello there. You are on Frogs of War Radio. This is Jamie and Melissa.
Jamie, Melissa, this is really bold of you guys to roll screenless. You have no idea who I am or what
I might
be here to say.
Well, if I had known it was you, I would have made sure to screen you too, my friend.
Yeah, we should have screened.
Don't worry, I know that voice.
Yeah, hi. It's DJ, AKA, one of my Riffram TCU. I've got a couple others out there that are going to remain nameless at this point, for as far as Twitter handles go.
All those Coach Patterson parody accounts.
Jimmy,
yeah.
Is that you? TCU fan 90? What?
Jimmy Conway.
Wait, I am not Jimmy. I do not live with my mother in her basement.
Hey.
Hot
take.
Jimmy, you know Jimmy's listening. You know, and
yeah.
I know Kyle's sitting here right now. He's listening too. He's like, we know he's listening. He's got nothing better to do.
Oh man, the hot takes. I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole.
I had to block two new Jimmy accounts this week already, so I'm going to look forward to blocking another one tomorrow.
I know.
The guy said
TCU was going to win a Big 12 championship. I was just waiting for Twitter to blow up, to be perfectly honest.
Oh,
remind me that I should get my shoes off and get back in the kitchen.
Yeah.
The guy is prolific. He is prolific.
He is also relentless. It's just unending stream of nonsense. But DJ, you called
so,
in,
so
the floor is yours.
Speaking of an unending stream of nonsense, I wanted to take us a little bit out of the political realm here, because it's football season. Yeah,
yes.
It's football season, and you know, whether you want to kneel, stand, hand over your heart like everybody else. I've got my opinion on that. But this is not my radio show, so I'm not going to give you mine. I want to know this, though. So Abby Faber's in town.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She's at, so she's on Coach P's radio show earlier, and which I think that's great as far as a feel-good story and in a moment from last season that, you know, a lot of us will never forget. With Boykin, you know, just impromptu kneeling down, you know, to talk to her. I just thought that was a great moment. And I guess my question is, do you think there's an outside shot that they got her to roll with the Riff Ram Give 'Em Hell video this week?
It would have been a repeat if they did, because she did it last year. Or no, was that?
West Virginia last year. No, that was last year.
It was West Virginia.
Virginia.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It was West Virginia game last year that they had her and her family come down for the game, and she was on the sideline, and they did that. So I wouldn't put them past it to do it again, because it is such a feel-good story. But, you know, I don't think they will, because they did it already last year.
I also understand, too, just from following along on Twitter last night, that they weren't – I know Del Conte was not aware she was in town for this. And so I feel like if that had been orchestrated, it could have been done last minute, of course. But I also do remember, too, that if it is Abby, it will not be Give Them Hell, TCU, because she is a sweet little girl and said Give Them Heck, I believe, last year. So
are you sure? I could have sworn she did say Give Them Hell.
I thought it was a heck. I could be wrong. Maybe I just want to believe in the innocence of childhood. But we do expect to hear from the Faber family tomorrow on Frogs of War. Shameless plug. We've been talking to them a little bit. So if you want to kind of get caught up on what the Fabers are up to as they come into town this weekend, assuming that they have time to get back to us with the questions and their busy travels, we may get a little bit of an update on one of our favorite adopted members of the Frog family and her entire family as they headed to Fort Worth last night. So I'm looking forward to hearing what's up with Abby and how she's doing.
Absolutely.
Guys, that's really all I had tonight. I just had to take it off the political page for at least 5 minutes, and then I'll let you back to it.
I think we'll stick with football here.
Yeah, we're going to stick to sports from here on out.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for taking my call. Go Frogs.
Go Frogs. Thanks for calling in.
Well, you can always count on a guy like DJ to get us back to what's really, you know, what we're supposed to be talking about, Melissa, and that is sports all the time.
Yeah, if we're counting on DJ to bring us back to on topic, then we are just, you know, we must have been down a heck of a rabbit hole. But
we appreciate the
turn in topics here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it is good because it gets us back to a place where we can easily pivot, as Marshall Weber would say, to some games around the Big 12 and around the country that are pretty intriguing based on what's happened in the first 2 weeks. We're obviously going to get to Ohio State, Oklahoma, but I wanted to start with a different game in the Big 12, Melissa, if that's okay with you, talking a little bit about Oklahoma State and Pitt, because I think that this is a really interesting matchup that's going to happen at 2:30 on Saturday afternoon on ESPN. So obviously ESPN thinks it's a big matchup too, because you've got an Oklahoma State team that is 2-0. I mean, they're 1-1, but they really are 2-0 because they got so royally hosed by Central Michigan last weekend and by the referees last weekend. And then you also have a Pitt team that just came on and took it to Penn State. You've got James Conner, who's running all over the place. And it's just some really – it's a really intriguing matchup for these two squads. And I'm excited to see how it plays out. You know, you've got Mason Rudolph out there slinging the ball around. So you've got this really pass-happy offense against a run-oriented offense in Pitt and two defenses that people really don't know quite what to make of yet.
Well, I mean, what Pitt did last Saturday, Penn State, not very good, nice interception by Cincinnati in the end zone, by the way, going the other way. So, that's nice. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what Pitt has done is quietly put together a really nice start to the season. And Penn State's going to struggle this year. You know, that's no surprise. But Pitt looks real. And anybody that, you know, we touched on James Conner's story, I believe, on our first or second episode, that, you know, he's a player that overcame a cancer diagnosis and scored 2 touchdowns in his first game back on the field and had a heck of a ball game against the Nittany Lions last weekend, and is looking not like a feel-good story, but like a legitimate NFL prospect at running back, which could not be happier for him. And just as college football fans in general, it's an amazing story and a really easy guy to root for. But Oklahoma State could be in trouble against this Pitt team. They have looked a little bit out of sync, not unlike what we've seen with the TCU offense. That James Franklin or the Franklin Mason Rudolph connection hasn't quite hit yet this year to what we saw them doing at the end of last year. And if this game wasn't at home, it would have been really easy for me to go with Pittsburgh. I just think they're playing better football right now. But, you know, Gundy had some pretty strong words and took a lot of blame and took the focus and the onus off of his team after the way that was mishandled by their officials Saturday afternoon. And just with the way that he's handled things, I'd expect this team to come back refocused and ready to play. And being in their home stadium, I think they find a way to get a win and kind of overcome their doldrums. The one thing that could really get them in trouble is if they fall behind early. Because after just getting your heart ripped out a week ago, if you fall behind a couple scores early in that game, it could be really, really tough to get yourself up to try to fight back again.
It definitely could. Melissa, we've got another caller, so we're going to go ahead and go to them. Hello, you are live on the Frogs War Radio Show with Jamie and Melissa. How are you?
Hey, guys, it's Kyle.
Hey, Kyle,
what's going on?
We knew after DJ called you out that you were going to have to call in. So
he called me out, and I was like, hell no. So I was like, all right, I'll jump on, talk to you guys for a little bit. How are things going?
Great.
You know?
Wow, looks we're like ready, we're ready for a big one Saturday.
Yeah,
I'm ready for Saturday, too. I'm ready to get that,
Houston.
I'm ready to get that last game kind of away from my memory.
Exactly.
Man, I'll tell you what, though. I was there. I was in the stands. I had a lot of fun, and I hate saying that, but it was the same feeling I had. I compared it to OU last year.
Yeah.
I wasn't at Oklahoma, but I was watching the game, and I remember, you know, we were down at one point, like, I think it was 12 or 13 points, and we came back, and we, you know, made a game out of it. And after the game, I wasn't that mad, and it was the same feeling in this game. I was disappointed. I was upset, but I wasn't mad, you know. I was like, we put some fight into it. We were down 20-7. We came back, you know. We should have won, but whatever. So anyway, hoping to get rid of that soon.
Well, I will say I disagree with you somewhat. I was in the stands at Oklahoma, and it was a much it was I left Norman feeling really good about life without all those guys. That loss Saturday sat with me a little bit longer than the loss in Norman. You know, maybe because we were quote unquote expected to win against Arkansas. Maybe it was because of the amount of injuries that we were dealing with against Oklahoma. But I hope that we can get the taste out of our mouth with a good performance against Iowa State and start looking like the TCU team that we kind of expected to see this year.
Okay, so we always listen to GP when he's having his pressers, and he says, you know, hey, we're not where we need to be, or the defense didn't step up today or whatever. And we always take that with a grain of salt because we think he's messing with us. But every now and then he's actually telling the truth. And I'm wondering if that's the case this year. You know, he was trying to tell us ahead of time, hey, you know, we have some work to do with the defense. We have some young guys on the team. They don't have a lot of experience. Sure, they played a lot of games last year, but their bodies are 19 years old. And I don't think anyone listened to that. I think we all just took that. We're like, oh, yeah, that's just GP being himself. And we kind of forgot about it. So I don't know.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I think you may be right on the money. Is like you said, we're used to taking his overhyped teams and trying to, you know, calm down expectations and calm down the egos in the locker room a little bit and just kind of keep his guys level and grounded. But this does kind of harken back to, you know, when we entered the Big 12 and seeing how he was kind of trying to temper and quell expectations coming off of a couple of veteran-laden teams and coming into a conference that we just hadn't built the depth for at that point. And so it's hard to know, like you said, when to take him at his word and when to think he's just kind of playing games a little bit. But you might be dead on. He may have known this team a little bit better than the rest of us did. which you would think he would. And maybe it was, we should have been taking them a little bit more straight up than we did, instead of kind of just brushing it off. Like, oh, that's just GP being GP. Because everything you said to this point has basically played out on the field.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely true.
So speaking of that, so why do you guys think we've been having a slow start in the first half and then coming out firing in the second half?
I think that when you have a young, inexperienced team generally like TCU is this year, it takes a while to get into the rhythm of the game, and especially against offenses where you're not used to seeing, with South Dakota State, it was the first game of the year. So you're working on just getting in position and getting your coverages right and getting the calls in from the sideline. And so there are a lot of things that you got to shake off the rust because it's been an entire season. And then you come into a game where you're playing Arkansas and it's an offense like you haven't really seen before. It's a defense that is a little bit different than what you encounter on your Big 12 schedule. And so it takes a quarter or two to really kind of feel out the game and get comfortable. So, I think that's really what I saw the first 2 weeks. Now, if it continues to happen, then there are some bigger questions to be asked about, what is the actual talent level of this team, things like that. But I think for now, it's really just still getting into the rhythm of the season with a bunch of inexperienced kids and a bunch of guys coming back from injury.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll know more this week about how many of these are fixable, solvable problems versus how many of these are just, the things that we're going to struggle with this young team. Three games into it, third straight home game, they should have a lot of those wrinkles ironed out and that they're able to be ironed out. So it'll be interesting to see if some of that gets cleaned up. I'm heading to the first Big 12 game of the season, or if we continue to see these patterns kind of repeat, then it might be time to start getting a little bit more on the concerned side rather than the, we'll get it figured out, which I think is where most Frog fans are right now.
Okay, so speaking of figuring it out, where are Deontay Gray and Kai Slimina, two of my favorite guys I was really looking forward to coming back this year?
Deontay just has not found his role in the offense yet. It seems like they're running Dez White out for a lot of the plays that we would have seen him, in a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I'm hoping that he's just kind of working the kinks out a little bit, getting back into game shape and feeling a little bit more comfortable out there, because Dez White is awesome and he's dynamic and he puts himself out there and absorbs a lot of big hits. Deontay Gray is just a bigger, stronger body, and I would love to see him kind of on those middle of the field routes, those 15-yard posts and those 20 yards down the field where you're going to get lit up on the other end. I just think Deontay Gray has a much better shot completing those passes than Desmond White does at this point in their careers. Ty Slimina, I think, has quietly been pretty steady. His blocking has been unbelievable to start the season. What he's doing in the run game and when Kenny Hill breaks out of the pocket, Slimina seems to consistently have a hold of somebody and making sure that they don't make the tackle. And he's made some huge third down catches early, too. With the amount of talented guys and with how good Turpin is and how much he needs to touch the ball for this team, I think Slimina and Gray are probably looking at, in that 5 to 8 targets a game range. And Slimina's kind of gotten there, in my opinion. Gray, we're still waiting to see him at full strength.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, Slimina has 9 catches this season through 2 games, which is not, number one receiver stats, but he's not a number one receiver. He's got 87 yards receiving, but he's losing a lot of receptions, I think, to Kyle Hicks, as odd as that might sound. Just because Hicks has shown himself to be quite proficient coming out of the backfield and catching the ball and running after the catch. He's already got 12 receptions on the year. A third of his touches almost have come from the passing game instead of the running game. And so I think as Hicks has started to emerge as a threat in the passing game and has really started to prove himself as a 3-down back, you've started to see receptions kind of leave other people and gravitate towards him. And that was a very poorly constructed sentence, but I think you guys understood what I meant.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah.
I think I was expecting Ty to kind of be that. Who did Colt McCoy throw to 15
Shipley?
Times a game? Yeah, Shipley.
Yeah, Jordan.
I kind of expected Ty to be that guy who no play goes to him. but he catches it every time because he's always open, you know. And mm-hmm. and maybe you're right. He's just been blocking and doing other stuff that's been helpful also.
Well, when you look at the numbers, you know, Turpin has 14 receptions. Taj Williams has 12, but what, 11 of those came in the first game? Kyle Hicks has 12, mm-hmm. and then Flanina is the number four receiver at 9. And so I think Kenny Hill looks for him quite a bit, and a lot of it does seem to be on those broken plays. I think you make a great point about that. But it'll be interesting to see how that develops. And, you know, Hill's still getting a rapport with these guys too, because as much as he was able to practice last year, he's practicing with the scout team. And so, you know, he didn't have a chance to throw the ball to Tyus Flanina. You know, he didn't have a chance to work with Kevontae Turpin. Taj Williams obviously has only been here since January, and Kyle Hicks played significant snaps last year. And so I'm sure part of that is just getting a rapport with these guys. And for a quarterback like Kenny Hill, who is not going to sit there, sit back in the pocket, but is going to get out, you know, to the edges and try to make plays with his feet and try to keep moving as the defensive line comes after him, it's just kind of getting that rhythm with those guys. And again, I mean, that's something we need to see continue to develop here over the next two games heading into the big matchup with Oklahoma.
Yeah, and that would definitely be the case even if Hill had taken all of the snaps in summer camp. But mm-hmm. we're led to believe that he was still trying to win the position through August, and that would, you know, imply that Foster Sawyer was also getting a substantial amount of reps with those guys. And so when you factor that in, then he's had even less time to really kind of build up a rhythm with these kids. So I think it will get better over time. I think he's done a phenomenal job so far. I tweeted out a stat earlier in the week that Kenny Hill, through his first two games of this season, has like over 950 total yards of offense, 8 touchdowns and 3 turnovers. And that is not something just to be scoffed at. So, you know, they're getting there. They're definitely getting there.
Oh, and what might have been on Deontay Gray Saturday. What might have been if a face mask gets called or a fumble doesn't get knocked loose. I think that would have been a huge confidence booster for him.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't want to sound like I'm always being negative. I've actually been very impressed with Kenny Hill, and I think he's definitely our option, you know, moving forward. I think it's easier to look at the negatives when you have a loss, you know, on your on your schedule.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, like you said, Jamie, I mean, he's got almost 1,000 yards, which is ridiculous. Who cares? It doesn't matter who you're playing. I mean, he's behind who? Pat Mahomes only in the Big 12, mm-hmm. Which I don't think any of us would have expected. I think, you know, obviously you got, you know, Russell, and I mean, there's other guys, and obviously Baker Mayfield, other guys that you would have expected to be higher than him, especially at this point. So, if anything, he helped us come back in the fourth quarter. Everyone's looking at that stupid sign, but we're past that by this point.
Yeah, yeah.
So speaking of him, so I saw this interesting stat on college football, some Twitter account. I can't remember, but I'm going to read it to you guys and see what you guys think. So don't think about total number, but just think of percentage of throws that he's making over 20 yards in a game. And right now he's at half of what Boykin threw. So he throws about 15% of his throws over 20 yards. Boykin threw close to 30%.
Wow.
All right. So his completion on those throws is also half. So Boykin hit 50% of his passes over 20 yards. And Hill is at about 27. So like a quarter, I guess. So I just think that's interesting. And with a long story, I'm looking at that going, are we really missing Josh Doctson that much?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Or are we consciously making shorter throws, thinking, hey, I'm going to throw 5 yards and he's going to run for 15? Or is it really that simple? Is it Doctson's gone and he's the guy?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, like you notice with the stats that they're asking him to do that twice or, you know, half as often. Part of that is I don't think we've seen the accuracy on the deep ball that Trayvon Boykin developed. And again, he didn't develop that until, you know, going into his third year of playing, well, second and a half year playing quarterback. And so I think Hill will be asked to go deep. And he has a really nice chemistry with Taj already on those deep balls. They're just not connecting very much. But the thing that it's easy to forget when we look back, especially in 2014, because it worked so much of the time, there were so many balls that Boykin just threw up and said, "Hey, Josh, go get that." And Josh, time and time again, went and got it. I look back to that Texas game in 2014, and he was thrown into double coverage and triple coverage, and I think one time into quadruple coverage, because Doxson was never single covered. You know, after the first month of that 2014 season, I don't think he saw one-on-one the rest of the year or the next year after that. And Boykin and Josh had such an incredible chemistry that, you know, Trey knew when to throw it up, and Doc knew exactly how to high. I mean, he's one of the best high pointers of the ball we've seen probably the last decade in college football. He just understood how to time his jump perfectly to catch that ball at his highest point, and nobody was going to, you know, beat his combination of size, length, and jumping ability, and it worked out time and time again. I don't know that that guy is on the TCU roster right now, though I think that that guy will exist before the end of Kenny Hill's career at TCU.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that, you know, just we cannot undersell how special of a talent Josh Doxson was, and we can't undersell how special of a talent Trevon Boykin was. You know, you go back to that Texas game. I go back to that SMU catch he had last year where he was running into the front of the end zone down kind of near the right sideline, and Boykin throws it up, and Doxson stops, plants, turns, and jumps all in one motion, and somehow works his body around the cornerback in the midair to come down with the football for a touchdown. And I just look at the height, the speed, the hands, the body control in the air, and the leaping ability. That's a five-tool player right there.
Yeah.
And that's so rare. It's just so rare. Everybody hopes that Emmanuel Porter can be that, but he's struggling this year so far. Everybody hopes that Taj Williams can be that. He flashed that in the first game, but now he's got to show that he can sustain that kind of success. You know, it's highly likely that maybe Isaiah Graham is the one that's closest to that, and he's only a true freshman, which means we might be 2 or 3 years away from seeing that type of talent out wide again.
You guys are describing all the reasons I picked up Docs in my fantasy keeper league. So he'll be there for the next few years.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I'm hoping that he gets a little bit more field time. You know, I don't necessarily claim a NFL team anymore, but I have a feeling he can do some real, real bad things to the Cowboys secondary this week if given the opportunity.
It's going to hurt and it's going to feel good, and I'm not going to know really what to do.
Yeah. I just, you know, it's Sundays. Other than that,
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing I tweeted out earlier this week is if you're a junior at TCU, this is the first home loss you've ever had.
So
it's so hard after, you know, you lose to think that, you know, the end is near and the season's over. But man, we are spoiled. You know, we're spoiled with TCU football. We've had a good few years, and I don't necessarily think the season's over at all. I think we have a lot to play for. Obviously the entire Big 12, because there's, like you said, Melissa, as cliche as it is, we're, 0-0 in the Big 12, and anything can happen. And based on what we've seen so far, there is no clear number one, regardless of Texas's win over Notre Dame. Notre Dame could end up with 4 losses with that defense. You know, who knows?
They'll be undefeated
positive.
In the Division League.
I'm optimistic, and I'm ready for the game on Saturday. I'll be there. So
be there.
Absolutely.
And thank God they're letting us wear purple.
Hey, it's a small miracle. But they told us to, so does it really count?
They told us to, yeah.
I might just wear white just to be that
just
guy.
Just to throw things off. Oh, man. We could do a whole hour and a half on what are your thoughts on color blocking the stadium. I feel like that could be a special report from Frogs of War podcasting.
It might be.
So
I've got about a 4,000-word article in my head about that crap, but.
Okay, so a close friend of mine works for an ad agency, or he used to, excuse me, that did like the referendum video and all that stuff.
Okay.
And so he met Del Conte multiple times, you know, in meetings and stuff. And they always said that the color blocking was not, it was not for this year or the next year or the next year. They are thinking long term. So they're like, yes, we realize that we, you know, people don't understand it or they don't get it or they don't like it. But in 5 and 10 years, if TCU is still good and we're still doing well, then it's just part of the process. It's part of
your
thing.
So what they're doing is brainwashing us?
Exactly.
Okay, I can get behind
exactly.
that.
So basically for the first 3 or 4 years, they know that it's going to be terrible and no one's going to like it. They know that. But over time, you just get used to it. You look at your tickets. You're like, okay, I'm wearing white. I've got, by this time, it's 5 years down the line. I've got 5 white shirts. And you just pick one and you go for it. You know, and at the same time, here's the thing. Del Conte on Twitter, he is the most cordial guy ever. Mm-hmm. And when people complain about it, he's basically like, don't wear white or don't wear this or do whatever you want. Like, he doesn't care. You know, he just wants you to go to the game, have fun, you know, cheer loud. And so if you don't want to wear that color, then don't wear that color. It's not mandatory.
They aren't turning people away.
Do what you got to do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, Del Conte, oh, man. I mean, that guy, what he deals with on Twitter, and it might have been you, Kyle, too, that tweeted about this, that we have become so entitled as a fan base that people feel that it's perfectly acceptable to complain about the dumbest stuff. I mean, my goodness, people, it's a football game. It's going to be loud. The music's going to be loud. They're going to be kids.
People are going to be standing.
They're going to be crying. Yeah, people are going to stand up in front of you. I mean, some
of
the stuff that we deal with is
he found himself in a catch-22 where he answers everybody, assuming they're not vulgar or whatever. So because he does that, now he has to answer everybody's tweet. Yeah, it's bad, including the ones that are not worth his time. So
yeah, and that's just another reason. Oh, we are so lucky to have him, and why all you whiners on Twitter need to shut up so he doesn't want to ever leave.
Exactly.
Stop talking. If you can't figure out a way to solve it yourself and it's not hurting you and it's not causing you physical or emotional pain, suck it up, buttercup, and get over it. Nobody cares.
It's like when you used to complain to your parents and they would look at you and say, are you bleeding? Okay, then just go figure it out yourself. Or at least that's what my parents did. I don't know about y'all's, but
yeah. No, pretty much the same thing. Oh my God, some guy was just doing toe touches on the Houston sideline, so I think they pretty much just eliminated themselves from Big 12 consideration.
Yeah, well, that's,
it was a coach. It wasn't a cheerleader. It was a coach.
Well, I just saw one of the guys doing the big balls dance too. So
yeah.
Apparently, they're pretty hyped right now.
We have one sideline dancing group, and that's really all we need.
And
hey guys, pleasure to talk to you.
Minimally dancing. Hey, thanks a lot, Kyle.
Kyle, thanks for calling in, bud. Always good to hear from you.
All right, I'll talk to you soon. All right.
All right, later, bud. So, yeah, Melissa, we can turn our attention to the Houston-Cincy game just a second because we got a question on Twitter about it. We've gotten a couple questions on Twitter, though, and so I think we should definitely get to those. The first one is from Kyle Bumgardner. He tried to call in, he said, but he lost connection. So he tweeted us his question. If you could pick one former TCU football player to be the next head coach, who would it be? And he says that he likes Andy Dalton for the gig.
That's a great question. Great question.
Yeah.
I'll let you go first on this one. Yeah, I want to mull this over for a minute.
So, you know, I also like Andy Dalton. I think I would go with someone like Zarnell Fitch or someone like Jason Phillips. Not necessarily because they're already on the staff, or maybe a Sam Carter, but just someone who, when they were playing, you could just identify them for being such an incredibly intelligent player, especially Sam Carter. You know, you look at what he did, how he got that defense ready to play, that secondary ready to play every single Sunday. He had guys in position. He could read defenses and make calls to the secondary before Patterson could, just because of where he was positioned on the field and because he knew the system so well. So when you talk about a guy who has an ability just naturally with his intelligence to come back and be a coach someday, and I think he's on staff with Missouri right now, isn't he?
Is he? Is that where he landed?
I think
I'm
he's with Missouri right now. But I'm going to go with Sam Carter.
I mean, I think that's a great call. And that's a guy that I would love to see show back up in Fort Worth, you know, here in the next couple of years as a defensive assistant, or, you know, maybe kind of take that role that Bumpus kind of filled, not just as a coach and as a mind, but just his energy and leadership, I think could be valuable on that side of the ball. But I'm going to go with the guy you mentioned as well. I love Darnell Fitch, and I don't want to see that guy leave. I love him as a part of that staff. I love the way he recruits. But I think Jason Phillips with Darnell Fitch as his defensive coordinator would be my pick for the head coach. I like Phillips' no-nonsense style. I love the toughness that he's shown. Like you said, he was another guy that knew the calls before they went out there. And he has the attitude and the toughness that I think would make a smooth transition from Gary Patterson whenever he decides to hang up the whistle. But I would like to see him as a partnership with Darnell Fitch and keep both of those guys around. They have been absolutely a boon for this TCU coaching staff, and there's nothing better than seeing your guys come back into the fold and have success, in the coaching ranks.
Yeah, there's definitely not. That's a really good question, Kyle. So we appreciate that one. We got another question from DJ, who was on with us earlier. He tweets, if the University of Houston was making a case for the Big 12 by beating Oklahoma, what implications could a Cincinnati win over Houston have for Big 12 expansion?
I don't know that Cincinnati is – I think Houston is such the darling of football right now that anything that they do well is going to make people jump to the conclusion that, well, they need to be in the Big 12. Look how good they are right in this moment. And they're so likable as a school, and Tom Herman is such a hot name. Honestly, at this point, they can do no wrong. And they've taken control of this game now, it looks like, and should be able to run out the clock over the next 10 minutes if they get one more score. Cincinnati, for whatever reason, while most people think they're a really attractive target, they just can't win for losing right now. And it looks like they're going to drop this game and kind of render that question irrelevant for the time being. But it's about so much more than just getting a single win. And Houston has that flash and that it factor, and they have Tom Herman. And I think it's less about, as much as everyone likes to say, it's about what's on the field. I think it's less about the actual results of the game, and it's more about just kind of the aura surrounding the program right now and what people think they could bring long-term to the Big 12.
Yeah, I definitely can see that. I got to push back a little bit, though, because I just, you know, after thinking through all of this over and over and over again, far more than any human should, I cannot see a situation where out-of-state schools want a fifth Texas school. And, you know, I think that's what it comes down to before it comes down to who's going to beat who in this game, on Thursday night. It's more about what's best for the conference as a whole. And I don't think that the out-of-state schools view Houston as being best for the conference as a whole when they go up against other schools like Cincinnati or BYU or UConn or South Florida, or Central Florida, whoever it is. You know, I don't know that the out-of-state schools are really willing to bend on that quite yet.
Oh,
so
I disagree.
I still think Cincinnati is the number one choice. I think they're the one at the top of the list. And I wouldn't be shocked if Houston and Cincinnati both got in. I would be totally shocked if we came to a time to expand and Cincinnati was not one of the schools that was coming into the Big 12.
Yeah, I'm starting to really doubt that the Big 12 is going to do anything right in any way, shape, or form. If I'm just being really honest, right now, it's just to be frank and to be blunt, I feel like it's such a pissing contest between Oklahoma and Texas that could not care less about the other eight schools in the conference. It's partially about money, but I think mostly it's about who is really the big boy on the block. And now that Texas has had a little bit of success and has a real good shot to go 3-0 after this weekend and a real good shot to go 4-0 after the weekend after that, and head into the Red River Showdown undefeated is very likely for them. All that's done is empower them and embolden them more. So, I think we've all heard the rumors, and I'm inclined to believe then that Texas is trying to expand into Houston with a medical school, and that there's a nice little, hey, we'll push for you to join, and if you drop your protest against us coming into Houston, and that just seems so believable because it seems so very Texas I find it hard to believe that this ends well for anybody not named Texas, and Oklahoma obviously would be fine too. But if this comes to a head and we've got both of those guys pistols in hand pacing out 10 steps, the only people to get shot, the other eight schools in the middle. And I don't see this ending well for anybody, to be perfectly honest. And I just don't trust leadership at the top to do what's best for the whole, unless that happens to also be what's best for Texas.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, Texas can hold a gun to schools all they want. And, you know, they do have a lot of influence and sway, but, you know, I don't know. I don't see Texas having as much sway as they typically do in an instance like this. I just don't.
I hope you are right.
But speaking of Texas, that's another good segue to kind of get back into some of these other games around the Big 12 that we were talking about earlier, because Texas does go out to the West Coast. They play Cal, a Cal team that just lost to San Diego State and doesn't look very good since the departure of Jared Goff. So like you said, I agree. I think Texas gets to 3-0 this weekend. I think it's a relatively easy win for the Longhorns. And with a second win over a Power 5/Notre Dame team, the sky is the limit as far as rankings go for the University of Texas after this weekend.
Well, you made one mistake there. You said a Cal team that hasn't looked very good since Jared Goff left. And let's be honest, that was a Cal team that didn't look very good with Jared Goff under center either. they're just
That's
not
fair.
Very good.
Yeah.
I mean,
this
is a program.
Well, they still beat UT last year.
But UT was real bad too. You can't take, the way that they won that game was, I miss the ineptitude, just the blatant and utter ineptitude of Texas special teams. I am waiting for that to come back. You know it's going to come back. It rears its ugly head at some point in the season. That's incredibly inconvenient, and I will be excited for that day. Cal is bad, and being from kind of that area, Northern California, it makes me a little bit sad, but this team is on the verge of kind of just roll over and play dead mode. They had a lot of drama in the off season as well. There's just a lot of bad stuff going on in that locker room with that coaching staff. This is going to be an ugly year if you are a Cal Bears fan. So the good news is I can always work this into a conversation. The in and out tastes much, much fresher and better on the West Coast. So at least
well,
Texas
I'll have to
has
take
that
your word for it. I'll have to take your word for it because I've been wholly unimpressed with the Texas in and out. So
it's very different world. What else do we have on tap before we go down the burger rabbit hole?
Oh gosh, we can't chase that rabbit tonight. We just don't have time.
Yeah.
We don't have enough
time.
The premier matchup in the Big 12 this week is obviously Ohio State and Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a team that desperately needs this win, not only for themselves and for their playoff chances, but really just to help boost what has been a very, very weak Big 12 team through the first 2 weeks. And they're going up against an Ohio State team that has just been leveling people. So, you know, I don't know how you feel about this game. I don't feel particularly good about Oklahoma's chances. Now, Ohio State has only played Bowling Green and Tulsa, but they've won those games by a total of 125-13. So, you know.
I mean, Ohio State is the better team playing better right now. I don't like to give away the picks here, but nothing would surprise me. Ohio State coming in and rolling Oklahoma would not surprise me. Ohio State winning in a close game would not surprise me, or Oklahoma finding a way to pull out a win would not surprise me as well. The only thing I can't see happening is Oklahoma blowing out Ohio State. So I do think the Buckeyes pull this off. I just, if I'm a fan of either team, I feel a little bit better about a big game like this with Urban Meyer in my corner than I do with Bob Stoops at this time. I'm just going to be really interested to see what the offensive strategy is for the Sooners. The way that they're going to beat the Buckeyes is not that much different from the way that Arkansas kind of took it to TCU early. Put the ball in the hands of your ridiculously talented duo of running backs and let them control the tempo. Keep Ohio State off the field. Have Baker use his legs, let him break out of the pocket, let him make some throws down the field, but keep things conservative, run the clock, run the ball, and hope that you can just wear down Ohio State and not give JT Barrett too many chances to beat you. That being said, this is a kid who grew up a Texas fan in Texas, and all he ever wanted to do was beat Oklahoma, and this is the one shot he's ever going to have to do it. So I fully expect him to show up big and make it happen.
Yeah, I do too. You know, I'm still waiting for Baker Mayfield to find that hate to be to his benefit. I'm not buying him. I'm not buying Lincoln Riley. If Lincoln Riley thinks that it's a smart game plan to go into Houston and only give it to his running backs 12 times, then I don't trust him, and I don't trust him to put together a good game plan for Ohio State. Nope. So
not with those two running backs. Yeah, that's,
you know, you have those two running backs. Terrible. You know, outside of Ed Oliver, a very small front for Houston, and you don't give them the ball. You just don't let them do what they do, and it's got to be frustrating for Sooners fans. I'm on the verge of being frustrated. I'm a Horned Frog, so
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Whew. It'll gonna be an interesting game, but I think it's the worst thing that could happen is Oklahoma just not show up.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll happen, but. It's sad that, you know, we're turning to the Sooners to boost our rep as we wait and see who the Longhorns actually are.
Yeah, it's kind of come down to the Red River Shootout, and then it's going to come down to October 1st, TCU, Oklahoma. We'll see. We'll just go from there, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. But first, we've got to get through Iowa State, which, as we said, shouldn't be too much of a problem, but nobody knows this year. You just never
know. Football
is a crazy, crazy game. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple other Big 12 matchups coming up as well this weekend, don't we?
Yeah,
at least one other. We see Kansas State back in action.
Kansas back in action after that close loss, closer than anyone expected it to be lost to Stanford. They're a favorite in this game. I see their defense, if it's anything like it was in week one, really helping them come away with the W there.
Yeah, they look really strong. Memphis is such a question mark with Justin Fuente, Paxton Lynch gone. I think Kansas State gets their first win of the season. It seems like a long time since we've seen them play football. And, you know, you give the old ball coach there, the Wizard, a couple of extra days of practice to prepare his team, and I think they'll have a great game plan for Memphis and make it an easy one.
Hang on. Now, Memphis is playing Kansas, not Kansas State.
Okay. That's my bad. I missed on that. I apologize.
Yeah,
Memphis is playing Kansas.
Kansas. Let's just make that clear.
Kansas. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
accidentally closed my screen here. But Kansas State is not playing Memphis. They are playing Florida Atlantic. So they're going to
– That's right, FAU. They should hang to have no problem with FAU, yeah.
They said, you know, Baylor's playing Rice. So, you know, there's
Baylor's
that.
Baylor's playing Rice, yeah.
Yep, Texas Tech, Louisiana Tech. So, you know, the big three games to watch really are Pitt, Oklahoma State, Ohio State, Oklahoma, and Texas Cal. And then, obviously, TCU, Iowa State.
Obviously. Indeed. Well, it is a big weekend for TCU current players. It is also a big weekend or big week for former TCU players. Those of you that haven't heard, go ahead.
No, I was disagreeing with you.
You were agree? Disagree with me. So for those of you guys that don't know, LaDainian Tomlinson is in his first year of eligibility for election to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Most expect that he will get in without issue heading into the first round of cuts, which will happen here in the next several weeks. But Tomlinson, it's hard to believe that he's been out of the league now for 5 years. He was around for my college season, as well as for my time in college. Sorry, I just had an autoplay come up on me, and that distracted me a little bit. but LT made the cut for the 55th class of the Hall of Fame and is one of 90 plus players to be listed on the original ballot. So they'll be cutting down from the 90s to the 70s to the 50s, and then they will announce their actual nominees during the Super Bowl week. And most would assume that LT should have no problem making that cut and be elected in his first year of eligibility.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone is a first ballot Hall of Famer, you know, outside of some of the bigger quarterback names, you know, LT's got to be up there in that first tier of running backs to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. I mean, the guy had, you know, 13,684 rushing yards over his career, with 105 rushing touchdowns. Just was such a monster. Stayed healthy for his entire career. You know, most of that with the Chargers, and then the last two seasons with the New York Jets, who actually just retook the lead over the Buffalo Bills in the third quarter. So, hey, there you go. Shout out to Matt Forte. Maybe it's just my bias, but he is obviously a first ballot Hall of Famer. I mean, averaged over 40 yards a carry for his career, averaged 80 rushing yards a game for his career. Also had close to 5,000 receiving yards. So he did it all.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone would disagree with you there. You know, even the most ardent of San Diego Chargers haters have to admit that LT was as good as anybody to strap on the cleats. Oh, my gosh, the cliches. This is such a problem. What is wrong with me? He's as good as there's ever been at that position.
You need to have a little
– you know, it's been a long week.
Coach,
you should.
Cliche.
Please do. Every time you say definitely, every time I drop a coach cliche, the Frogs of War drinking game is in full effect. But LaDainian Tomlinson is actually going up against a couple other running backs. So he will be with Terrell Davis, who, how is he not a Hall of Famer already? And Edgerrin James.
Definitely.
So, yes. You know, Edgerrin James, he just strapped those cleats on and played hard every game and gave 110%. So every time he stepped foot on the field, so drink.
Definitely did.
So it'll be it's a good class of 94, but I don't see any way that LT doesn't end up having his bus in Canton here next summer.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Definitely. All right. One other really great story to share with y'all, as we like to, you know, obviously finish on a positive note. If you are not familiar with the story of Kalen Moore, he is a TCU safety. You may not have heard his name or seen him on the field all that much, former walk-on. But this is a really, really special kid, and we don't have time to go through everything that he's done because he's just done so much and overcome so much to make it to this point in life. But he is originally from California, so west side, best side. He is carrying a 3.9 GPA, and he is majoring in economics with a double minor in mathematics and sociology. So this is a highly intelligent kid here at TCU, and he has recently been recognized for his good work, not only on the field, on the practice field, but off the field as well, by the Allstate AFCA Good Works team. And this is recognized as 24 student athletes across all levels of college football for their community work, their selfless acts, character leadership, and academic standing, which Kalen Moore checks off every single box on that list. So just a couple of the things that he's done for TCU. He started TCU Spark, which is a youth outreach program. He started that last spring. Several other TCU football players and athletes across campus are involved in that program. A really excellent program that works with disadvantaged, underprivileged youth in the Fort Worth area and helps to give them opportunities and put them in a mentorship program to give them the best chance to succeed academically and athletically. He does a lot of speaking engagements with young kids, working with elementary school, middle school, intermediate school kids. Works, speaking of LaDainian Tomlinson, he's been working, volunteering with his Touching Lives Foundation, does a lot with the Thanksgiving giveaways, Real Skills Network, which is, again, more work with elementary school kids. He's just really become a fixture in the community for TCU and one of those guys, like many of our players, that you can truly be proud of, not for what he accomplishes just on the field, but the way that he represents TCU and TCU football in the community as well. So really excited for him. There's generally a community vote that's a part of this award. And so, of course, as we get closer to that part of it and as they narrow down to the finalists, I can't imagine Kalen won't make that final cut. And we'll be sure to publicize where you can vote for him and how you can support him as he tries to win this All-State Good Works Team award this season.
That's phenomenal. That's a phenomenal story about a guy who – you know, the average TCU fan probably doesn't know just because he's never really stepped foot on the football field. So that is definitely one of those feel goods.
Absolutely. And there's a great story. If you guys want to learn more about Kalen, TCU 360 did a report on him last spring and just kind of shared his story and the way, you know, he's really come up from nothing. He was homeless at one point, sleeping in a parking lot, went to Marist College initially, where he was a Fulbright scholar, which, if you guys know anything about that, that's a ridiculously high honor to receive. Worked as a janitor to, you know, just kind of pay his way through school. Ended up at Princeton for a semester, but really, really missed playing football, and was able to kind of matriculate down to TCU, and what an incredible addition he's been to the TCU community.
Yeah, will you tweet that article out from the Frogs of War account?
I would be more than happy to do that.
Awesome.
We'll make sure we get that out there for y'all.
Perfect.
Well, hey,
right,
it
Melissa.
Has been quite a show.
It has been. It's been solid.
Yeah, we've touched on quite a bit of topics here, trying to cover the broad spectrum while we watch a couple of really exciting football games, except that one football game just seemed to get a little bit less exciting, and seems by all appearances Houston has wrapped up a victory here.
Yes.
Over Cincinnati, which is about 3.5 minutes to go, as they just scored on a pick six to make it soon to be 33-16. NFL game, a little bit of a back and forth affair. But you guys shouldn't be watching any of those. You should have been listening to us. And thank you for those of you that did just that tonight.
Yes, absolutely. Frog fans, we'll be back on Sunday night. We have a special guest in store for you. We'll let you know who that is later in the week. But for now, I am Jamie. She is Melissa. Go Frogs. Y'all have a good night.
Go Frogs. Beat Iowa State.